Hello and thank you very much for downloading this episode of Discussing Documentaries. Today, myself, Matt Wills, and let me at least get your name out.
Every time. Oh mate, I just worry about the time when, like, you know, because when you get to an age and you just sound like a broken record, or like after.
Well, this is about the 60th time.
What's the robot called in Aliens that he starts to glitch after he's been ripped in half and milk just comes out of your mouth? Go, welcome to this.
And that funny bastard was Rick Wharton, and we are comedy partners. And this is episode 5 we're doing of The Jinx, the life and deaths of Robert Durst. And this episode is called Family Values. And it's a documentary examining the life of property heir and suspected murderer Robert Durst. Now, I've just done a quick recap, right? So I know we did a recap on episode 4, but a lot changed in episode 4. So just here we are, right? Multi-millionaire Robert Durst's wife goes missing in the 80s. His best friend and press agent, the gangster's daughter, is killed 20 years later. Body parts of a man wash up on a beach in Texas, and Robert Durst is arrested for murder of his neighbour, who was in the bags. He skips bail. Years later, he's arrested for shoplifting a $6 sandwich with $38,000 in his car. He goes on trial for murdering his neighbour in Texas. He's found not guilty. How did that happen? Oh, that's right. He's a multimillionaire. He's found not guilty, even though he admitted it in a call to the jury. He contacts the director, Andrew Jarecki, who made a movie based around what a skeptic would say he did to his wife, as well as all the other murderers that he may murders that he may or may not be involved with. And he decides to give his first ever interview. And that's where we are. And it's episode 5 of 6. And I've seen episode 5 now, obviously, because we're just going to talk about it. Let's just wrap this up, because I want to watch episode 6.
I know, you'll be chomping at the bit for number 6, because you're like, oh, they're kind of going over. Because it starts off with kind of the aftermath of the court case. And it shows you just in pop culture how famous the story was. So you can kind of see how this has built a huge thing in his mind of, like, how observed he is, or talked about he is. Because it's SNL sketches about him. It's on the Daily Show. It's on absolutely everything. Yeah. And they're all just...
It's on the front page of the New York Times, the New York Post. He's there.
And then you have lawyer Dick DeGaron, without his cowboy hat, saying, well, you know, we are in a capitalist society. And he's a limo taking him out of prison, which is just fucking something else. That you see the limo leaving the correctional
facility.
Some
people drive Cadillacs. I want to know, other people have to buy secondhand cars. That's the way the pickle squirts.
I want to know if that was footage of Bob Durst leaving jail, or the director just went, right, we'll rent a limo, we'll drive through the gates of the jail and then just reverse and come back out.
There's a great James Wood film where he sets up a con, and it's all around boxing, and he gets out of jail in the opening scenes, and he gets into a car with a really pretty woman, and he gets into the driver's seat, and nothing happens, and the guards look at him from the prison and go, puh, didn't even get a kiss on the cheek. And the woman then leans over as if to give him a blowjob. And James Wood looks over at the prison guards, winks, and just speeds off. That's, I think, how Robert Durst left prison.
I know, but, like, if you've been in jail and that happens, I mean, what, you're lasting 9 seconds? Like, how, like, you'd look cool to the guards for 9 seconds ago.
I don't know. It'd be better without the stubble, I think. You know, that's...
Well, that's about as raunchy as I've seen you get, Matt. Just
I don't do
a James Wood blowjob. That's what you get on the Patreon feed.
It's a great film. I can't think of the name of that film. It'll come to me.
There's got to be grainy VHS for us, our whack-off material in this disgusting documentary.
Worth watching that film. It's got Lou Gossett Jr. in it. There you go. Right. So, just to remind you of the rules, I'm not allowed to watch any of the episodes in advance. I don't know what's happened. I've got a good idea, but I'm not so sure. And the more I've watched it, parts of my brain are booting up, going, is it? No, that can't. What?
because of how much has been mentioned. I even saw little snippets of it. This is how much it's mentioned at the time and around it. It was a relatively super famous story.
Yeah, and it was in season three of Big Mouth, right? They made a reference to it. Yeah. And that was only released last... No, this 2020. So it's still, you know, it's still around. So this episode starts off and it says, the bad publicity from Robert Durst being in court had no effect whatsoever on the billion-dollar Durst Real Estate Company. Really? Well, that's no surprise, is it? Sorry, we're moving out of your retail offices in downtown New York because of your brothers, who's not connected with the company in any way. He's a bad guy. Come on, who's going to do that?
Yeah, exactly like that. And it's also kind of, it shows you just how successful. They've just been given control of the Freedom Tower, which is, I believe, what replaced
that's
the Twin Towers.
Yeah, yeah. They're in charge of the rent and the running of that place. But no one knows who their landlord is in an organization. I mean, I do. I was that's what I organized with. So I knew who the landlord was. But any of my colleagues I spoke to, they wouldn't have a clue that it was run by the Durst family. They turn up, they do their work for whoever they're working for.
And what was I going to say? So we then meet Evan Krieger.
What a nice guy.
just wish Sideshow Bob was stood next to him, because that is Christy the fucking clown right there. When I see Evan Krieger, I see a man. Now, he is the nephew of Douglas Durst. Now, right there is a man determined to be poor. He is doing his very best. What the fuck? I'm looking at him, and I think it's the biggest crime of this documentary is, why the fuck are you talking? You have everything, you idiot.
Well, his mum is Robert's younger sister, right? Is that have I got that right?
I believe so.
We meet him, and he said, he's going, you know, my...
Got his guitar in shot for the chat.
And he's talking about how much his family didn't talk about it, because there was nothing that could be done, pretty much.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for turning up.
As much as I'm taking the piss, he's a nice guy.
Lovely guy.
You just think, why are you rich? Like, he's jeopardizing generations of his family's wealth from his bloodline.
I know exactly why he turned up, and it's because of the interview later on with Robert Durst's brother, Doug, because we finally get an insight into this jabroni's bloody style, and it's not very nice. Douglas Durst is not he's a DD, daredevil. He's not a very nice guy, and the reason that he's in it, Evan Krieger, is because it paints the initial picture of what a shitbag Douglas is and how privilege treats you when you've got that money.
Well, we'll get to that, because this is, again, another bridging episode, which is amping you up to the exciting bit. I think it kind of apexes for the court case and what happens, and then it builds again, and the final two episodes are great. So this should all really be one episode, because it's not fair that Matt is able to watch this and then not see the next one.
I've got a good lookalike, though. So the DA who's put the charges against Durst, Janine Pirro, in her pink suit, she is Marge from the Simpsons episode where Marge climbs the social ladder, and she...
Oh, she gets the Chanel suit.
She gets the Chanel suit. Yeah, yeah. That's Janine Pirro. If you want to reference that, it's called Scenes from a Class Struggle, and it's episode 14, season 7 of The Simpsons. There you go.
You're just desperate to do research, aren't you? Just absolutely fucking desperate.
I was gagging to research something. And the reason I'm late today, I nearly started watching that episode just to go, oh, what if I can get something out of that?
What if you... So we then meet Detective Ed Murphy, and he's going through stuff that happened at the time, and... we learn about a guy called Nick Scapetta, which was the family lawyer for Robert Durst when Kathy disappeared 20 years ago. And Scapetta gets in touch with the detective, the one who just basically stonewalls every question, but keeps on getting interviewed. I would stop turning up to these interviews if I
That's
was
Detective
him.
Michael Strzok. He's the one who sounds like Colin Quinn.
Strzok.
Yeah. He's a New York police guy who he was the investigating officer who he had a Rick Wharton approach to investigating murder with his work ethic, because he done fuck all on that murder inquiry, is my stance on it.
Mr. Strzok, my wife's disappeared. Hey, a lot of people disappear. I found he had a list, say, strangle, bury, deny. And goes, yeah, that could be a list about anything. You could say that about chicken, couldn't you? I mean, what's that
what you going
to
do about it? Hey!
But so Nick Scapetta gets in touch with the detective after Bob's went and talked to the police once and said that Bob really appreciates your help, but in future, all questions and investigations will go through me. By the way, I'm the most expensive crime lawyer in New York.
The thing is, his investigator, Nick Scapetta's investigator, is a chap called Nick Wright. His report that they then looked at.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. So Nick Scapetta hires a private eye. So Nick Scapetta is an ex-DA. So he's high up in the police himself at one point before he
And he knows private. Everyone, right?
Then Ed, yeah. And then Ed Wright was even further high up. And then he did some private freelance work. So they basically hired a police officer to go and find out what the police were saying. And he did his own investigation, which was the investigation that should have been done. So he does a full list and gives it to the Durst family.
And it showed, this report showed inconsistencies in Robert Durst's initial story. So, for instance, he gave three different versions of where he phoned his wife from. Oh, I was in a restaurant. Oh, I went to a payphone. Oh, I did this. I phoned her from here. Didn't happen.
The interesting thing with this is because they ring him. And now this is always a red flag for me in documentaries. When you get to the point where you see the documentary makers in real time, you think they either have something amazing or they've got nothing. Whenever you see the researchers there with their fucking Ted Baker satchels walking around with a boom mic, you're like, all right, we're filling time now here, guys. We're done with the cool footage of fucking what happened in the jail cells. So that's a way. And then they get in touch with him. And the first thing Scapetta says is, Ed Wright, sorry, says, I was actually hired in a legal capacity. So that's all privileged information. I wouldn't feel comfortable saying any more than that. And then there's a blank screen, goes, the director's obtained a copy of this report. There's not even a scene in between. Goes, yeah, we obtained the copy of the thing report we wanted from this guy who...
And the doorman, the other thing, and the doorman, who was key to Robert Durst's alibi. The doorman of when Robert Durst let his wife go and she went to the city of New York and went to their apartment, said he saw her. When they spoke to the doorman, he said he didn't. So who initially said the doorman saw her? Was that Susan Berman, his press officer?
I think that's Susan Berman.
Shit, right, okay.
Planting that. So that also shows that Strucker, the detective, never even went and did that. Do you know what I mean? Never even went and checked, called the doorman to ask.
And then Nick Wright was then let go so that the Durst family could pursue other avenues of interest on the investigation.
They said we mutually agreed that I shouldn't continue because I've just said that your son is 100% guilty of murder.
Which means Seymour and Douglas, effectively, who employed Capetta, who employed Nick Wright, they knew that their kid brother stroke that their son, Seymour's son, Robert Durst, they knew he was something's rotten in Denmark.
Which is why they go into it and they're like, oh, when the firstborn doesn't get chosen to succeed in the company. Yeah, because they had the evidence he killed his fucking wife. I wouldn't put him in charge
of
the Freedom Tower.
Because that might affect, if the guy who's running the Durst family organization, that might affect the bottom line.
Yeah, that would be that would be a game changer. Not to mention, like, if someone doesn't pay the rent, Robert just turns up in his house wearing a fucking wig and his phone turned off, and all of a sudden you get one in the back of the head.
Yeah.
Like so that's why, in my mind, that's why he got seceded. That's why he never became the head honcho as it was meant to be.
Well,
and this is diced in with, like, the interview still with Robert that we've seen throughout.
Yes, yeah.
With little editorials there. And
they also introduce us to some of Kathy, the wife who went missing's family. And effectively, what the family are saying is, we've had no closure. We don't know what happened to Kathy.
Here's the thing. Why did they interview him at work at B&Q? Like, couldn't you just got to sit down with him in a chat? Don't make him be there with the apron. And well, pay him to do the documentary. Like, don't be like, oh no, we'll just go on in. He's willing to talk. But he said one of the funniest things that's sad that it's in the documentary. He says, so it's the 30-year anniversary of Kathy going missing, I believe, 30 years. He says, so I actually got up at Mass and led the congregation. We said prayers for Kathy and for Bob. For Kathy to have closure and for Bob's conscience. what I wouldn't give to hear that prayer. How do you word that prayer into this? And I pray for this guy because he's an absolute cock.
Yeah, because he killed my sister. That's the bottom line. Right?
Passive-aggressive prayers. That's a beautiful side of Christianity you don't see enough in TV, just the passive-aggressive side.
There's a really great talking headshot of Kathy's mum, and she says, wouldn't it be good if something came from the making of this documentary? And right then, the memory synapses in my brain, which have been slowly coming together while I've been watching this, are like, yep, I'm right. My theory, I've got to be right. Because that, to me, was the cement of what I think. And I'll save that for episode 6, because then we can see if I'm right or not. Obviously, I'll know first, because I'm going to watch episode 6, probably in about 12 minutes' time, once we finish recording this.
So then we're back to Krusty the Krieger, and he says, I wrote an essay.
This is brilliant.
Trying to deal with, who gives himself an essay to do? Rich people don't know what to do with free time. That's the problem. This is why Bob kills people. And he says, I wrote an essay, and someone suggested, and I don't know who gave him this advice, is to try and contact Douglas to get his take on it.
Uncle Douglas.
And it's
Durst.
Just like, so then it was a negotiation. So I got three questions. And the three questions are shot down with the aggressiveness of a lawyer that you've ever heard of in your life. The question number one was like, do you remember Aunt Kathy? And he goes, my memories of Aunt Kathy are my own.
P.S. Please fuck off. Because that's what that answer says.
Question number two, former nephew. I bet the response to that was the first time he was referred to as Krieger and not Durst. I don't remember what question number two was, but question number three is, do you think the DA's office will pursue
charges
against? And the response was, I have no idea how the DA's office operates.
The questions were as open. They were nice questions, but the answers were beautiful. It was, now fuck off. You've had your three questions. Go away. You know when Homer Simpson goes to Nepal and he goes, right, you get three questions. Are you really the head of the crooked bar? Yes. Really? Yes. Really? Yes. Come again. Apu Masapahimatepepalop. Who, weirdly enough, is replaced in that episode by, do you know who by?
No.
James Woods.
Oh, right.
James Woods goes behind the counter and takes over because he's a method actor, isn't he?
How weird is
that?
Remember.
We need one more reference of James Woods. Great, we can get the James Woods blowjob bit stays in. So Andrew Jarecki calls Douglas Durst, who is Robert's brother, and he's the head of the Durst family real estate business, right? And his spokesman calls back Andrew Jarecki and says, yeah, I'm returning the call of Douglas Durst. And he says, yeah, I wanted to speak to Douglas Durst. And he goes, yes. And he goes, well, can I speak to Douglas Durst? Yes, I'm returning his call. Yeah, but you're not Douglas Durst. No, I'm not. And everything about that call is so awkward and standoffish. It's just brilliant. And then eventually the spokesman goes, yeah, he doesn't want to be involved in your film. Thank you. Click.
Do you know, because they're going through extra people to interview during this one. They don't have an end to the documentary at this point.
But they don't even know what they've got. I don't know what. Yeah. At this point, I don't know what they've got.
It's definitely sellable because they've got Robert Durst sat down. That's the hook. That's the key that they've got because it's fucking, they've got true crime history because they're sat down with the guy that got away with it. This is OJ fucking sitting down with fucking Frost Nixon type stuff is what they've got in their mind. But at this point, here's who I would like to have seen an interview with. And he's not in it, unfortunately. Spoiler alert. The flasher that said he knows who killed Kathy.
Yeah, the grass. Yeah, yeah. What happened to him? He's not been...
You don't need to go all Phil fucking Mitchell on him.
Like, he's a grass. That's what he is.
He's a fucking grass. Yeah, all right. You're a grass if you tell on someone in school. If it's about a murder of an innocent woman, you're doing the right fucking thing, all right? Like, there is...
Are you, Rick? Are you? What's the code of ethics you sign up to when you become a crook? Come on.
I mean, I'm not defending the flasher too much. It's like the idea of Ricky having gone, look, can you put that away and tell us what you know?
Just tell us what you know, Bill. That's all we want to know.
Just the guy from Juice Bigelow going, what do you think of this?
Now, Ricky won't take no for an answer, right? So he wants to see Douglas Durst. So he hijacks him at a dinner in honour It is a brilliant bit of footage because the opening line, Jarecki says, hey, I'm Andrew Jarecki.
To set the scene. So Douglas is getting like one of those rich guy lifetime achievement awards.
For a children's foundation.
When they have a banquet in his honour. Yeah. And it might as well be in the I've Never Known Someone Who Is a Murderer award goes to Douglas Durst. And everyone's applauding, and he has his own little line about, this is weird, I'm still a hippie from Berkeley, which he seems like a hippie when
he looks
him
very
talk
hippie,
like.
Doesn't he?
Yeah. There's nothing that I've seen more of a hippie than fucking Douglas Durst. So they set up the scene really well. So they have a guy with a hidden camera on Douglas, and then Jarecki goes and talks to him.
And it's brutal.
Which, how they signed the release to get this footage, I don't know if they did or didn't, but I imagine he's locked up with legal. So Jarecki goes up to him.
Jarecki just goes up and he goes, hey, I'm Andrew Jarecki. I'm doing a film about your brother. And the opening word from Douglas Durst is, you're not successful. That's white rich guy privilege right there. That's his opening statement, and that's pretty much all he says.
Yeah.
And Jarecki's like, well, yeah, I didn't aim to be that successful. No, but anyway, we're making a film about your brother. Do you want to be in it? Well, we could talk maybe. Anyway, nice to meet you. Ta-da. You're not successful.
I like that. There's an element. Now, I know in my mind, I think it's because this guy is rarely caught on the hop.
Yeah.
All right. He's a multi-billionaire, head of the company. He gets a memo about the chat he's about to have with his wife. Like, this guy is rarely caught off guard or feel threatened. So when he tried to be witty, he was too harsh. Because you said, I'm trying to make a documentary. He goes, well, you're not being very successful, are you? Because basically he's saying, I'm not going to do the documentary, but you sound like a cock. But I do like the idea that it was that much... over what he had to say, that much like overtly. It's almost like, you ever seen, I think it was Derren Brown when he was on the Joe Rogan podcast, he talks about how he had this method that was to, if someone ever started a fight with him, to make their feet freeze to the ground, is how he was trying to develop.
Right.
And he tried it out and the guy just wept in tears. So what is this guy comes up to him, aggressive energy, desperate for a fight. Yeah, what are you fucking looking at? Da, da, da. And he just says a phrase, and the phrase was, defenses in Spain are much shorter, but the trees in Nepal are very tall. Now, what that does is it's that level of confusion with the adrenaline. It causes an adrenaline dump and just confuses you. And the guy just started crying. Now, I believe Derren Brown because I've seen some cool live shows. What I won't do is try that out in a kebab shop.
On a Friday night in Chesterley Street.
Because he could just be telling that. That might not be true. Do you know what? He's a magician at the end of the day, like, although he says what he's doing is fake. So like, I don't want to be starting out in a kebab shop and go, the trees in Spain are... And then someone's got an anecdote and goes, he starts talking about fucking trees in Spain, so I fucking uppercut the daft bastard. And he's talking about fences on the floor. I just kept kicking him. It was funny as fuck.
The minute Chips he got to a tree, he hit the fucking floor. What a prick.
But this is an interesting thing. So then you have like them leaving this banquet and he's saying like, oh, you can almost like identify with Bob about how he got like taken over and cut out by the family. And here's the funny thing. This is like in your mind and your emotions because you're watching this. because he's unwilling to do an interview, it almost seems like Douglas is the dick of the movie, not the guy who's clearly killed people.
At least three, that we reckon.
At least he's willing to sit down and give us a story, but this guy, fuck him with his billion-dollar company.
To be fair to Douglas, he is at an award ceremony in his name for all the great work he's done for a children's charity.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a rich guy prick, admittedly, but he's not that much of a dick, is he? He's just rich and...
And then they show you that when Bob was on the run, he turned up at Douglas's house with guns.
Yeah.
And that's when Douglas had got a restraining order against him. And you see Douglas's house, which I'll be honest, I mean, I know it would be a big townhouse, but...
I was disappointed.
You'd imagine it would have something better, yeah.
That was flat-fronted, terrible windows. Yeah.
I mean, I imagine inside is like the TARDIS. It's like a three-story like block of flats that's just theirs. But you got Bob, because they're even like, they're getting footage of Bob walking around and then Douglas's security team's turning up outside the office building because they've got Bob with them for the day, which is weird. You can this is just getting stock footage, basically, yeah, for the documentary.
And also, what we see here is another Andrew Jarecki. He hijacks a minimum wage security guard and starts asking him questions about the building. And he says, well, who do you work for? To the minimum wage security guard, which I think at this moment in time is probably no one, because he puts him in a documentary. He probably gets the sack, right?
If he said anything wrong, he would have. He didn't mention the Durst fan. He goes, well, that D means Durst, doesn't it? But Jarecki's kind of got this image like they're out to get us because we're making a documentary. He's like, I think they're watching Bob. I would be like, oh, Bob Durst is downstairs. We'll send the biggest security guards we've got to stand around him at all times.
And they do, don't they? They have like six security guards and they keep cutting. So like, look how shifty these blokes look. Yeah, because their job is to keep the bloke who's signing their mortgage checks alive. He's putting food on their family's table. If he gets shot, Billy's not getting a Christmas present this year.
And you see Bob in fucking Starbucks.
Bob. That's a latte. Bob.
I never knowingly ordered a cappuccino. I didn't intentionally order a frappe.
And they said to Robert Durst, why don't you get on with your brother? Oh, it goes back to when we were five. He stole my toys.
That's when he's being like deposed for the Galveston trial. That's when he's in his orange jumpsuit.
Yeah.
And he's getting laughs.
He's getting laughs
in the interrogation room. Because he's a pussy. This like, I know you turned up at his house of guns when you're on the run for murder, but this guy, he's got some delivery.
What did he, when he goes back to his cell and like the two big fellas in his cell are like, how'd it go, Bob? Yeah, it was good. You know, they laughed a little bit. They liked the toys stealing bit. They liked that. That went down well.
Yeah, the handbag stuff works. I'm going to use that.
I need a closer, though. I need a closer.
I like the jumpsuits. These are comfy. I'm going to keep these. Okay, Mr. Bob.
And then we get back into this episode, one of my favourite people in the whole documentary, because we've not seen her.
Love her.
It's Deborah Lee Chariton, and it's his current wife. And basically, she's being deposed again, right?
But then they give a little bit more of a backstory because they say, well, the day that the story broke, they're reopening the case. Bob went and bought a wedding ring, and now those two have spousal privilege. He also gave her power of attorney.
What's spousal privilege?
In America, you cannot be forced to give evidence against your husband.
Really?
Yeah, it's another rich guy thing. That's like, all right, this fucking she knows some shit. We can't put her on the stand. So it's another rich guy law. So your wife.
But they're just not. Well,
I think it's their choice then. But yeah, legally, it's the same as lawyer attorney privilege.
Okay, all right. Well, Jeanine Pirro, the DA, very sarky about Deborah Lee, because she says, "Yeah, she was smart. I mean, well dressed, highly intelligent."
You can imagine them having a passive aggressive chat over a martini in a high cocktail bar, can't you?
Smart woman. Didn't remember where they were at Christmas when they were newlyweds, though, did she?
Yeah.
Okay, Jeanine. Looks like she's got to you. Great suit, by the way.
And then they've got the time scales. So then they go through Susan around the time of Susan Berman's murder, they can put him in. He goes to Trinidad, which is the back end town of California. He then gets his car picked up on the 19th,
yeah,
and he leaves on X date. So basically, he switches his phone off, and Bob's like, there's no records of where Bob is for like 6 days, yeah, which over that 6 days is enough time to drive from Trinidad to kill Susan Berman and then go and get a flight from San Francisco. But that's what they've got. They've just got 5 days where he's not reachable.
Yeah. And he's looking more Bob guilty does this to thing, me.
Right? When he does this, like his childlike Dennis the Menace shrug, he goes, California's a big city, and smiles. Forget this is his best friend of 30 years has been murdered. He's like, hey, they can put me in there. Can they put me in a house? You know.
Well,
anyway,
it's the way
I bought
he
a bone
that.
Saw again.
Yeah. It's the way he says that. It's just brilliant. It then cuts to
there is a little thing he does when he says California is a big state. He smiles and then has to physically, watch this in the documentary, he has to physically remove the smile from his own face with his mouth. He literally has to rub his hand over and go, he's smiling.
And he rubs his smile. I'm so guilty.
And he goes, rein it in, Bob. Rein it in.
And then we meet Sareb Kaufman again, who is effectively the adopted son of Susan.
Well, Sareb gets in touch, and what a fucking Sareb getting in touch here.
This changes
right now,
everything.
This is like getting in touch with George Lucas in the 80s. Goes, I found this glowing sword that makes a noise.
70s.
Now, is there anything he can do with this? Could this be a thing that would change your life?
He finds a box of audio tapes and a letter that has the same handwriting as the letter that was sent to the police stating that Susan Berman was dead. Now, here's my Jack the Ripper, I know who did it bit, right? That's too convenient. What, that Sareb finds a letter with exactly the same handwriting and the same misspelling of Beverly Hills? No fucking way, man. Listen, here's the thing. Sareb killed Susan Berman, right? And the reason he did that is he's not a wealthy guy, but Susan Berman did the shakedown on Robert Durst because she knew that he killed his wife. Robert Durst paid her off with a boatload of hard cash. Sareb's gone round there, nicked the cash, killed Susan Berman, and then he's framing Robert Durst. Job done, mate.
He was in Europe at the time.
Nah, job done. It's oh really?
He's in Europe. He's got an alibi.
No.
I would love just to go in at you going, you read a contrarian, but that there is a proved fact that he saw her on the 19th and then flew to Europe on the 20th or something like that.
No, there's records of him flying, right?
How do you, like, how did he fabricate I'm not putting up with this fucking Fahrenheit 9/11 bullshit contrarian attitude for you at this point in the 6-part episode.
He's got a box full of cash. Let's call it $250,000. He's only got to give some junkie a few grand to go, here, go and cap one in the back of her head, will you? It's easy. You're looking at me like, that's because you know the ending. You clearly know I'm wrong here. Yeah, okay, all right, I'll shut up then.
You've ruined it for everyone. Sareb did it. Sareb did it.
But he then starts crying as well. He's like, oh my God, I've let a murderer into my home. Shut up, Sareb. It all seemed too false. No, I didn't buy into it at all. And his box of
I just wanted, you know, when they're getting stock footage of Bob, because they're walking around Times Square, Starbucks, and then to Douglas's house, and they're even like in the background going, I don't think he's going to want it, because this is Bob leading this, and Bob's not going to stop being at the front door till someone tells him to go away, like,
yeah.
And I just wonder if they just got him to do, you know, the act out of like the clearly Bob Durst posting the cadaver letter that they've got sprinkled in places with the napkin over the letter as they're posting it.
I'm not with you.
Do you know that?
No, I'm.
There's a little bit of stock act out footage where it's a guy walking with the note and posting it in the letterbox. I wonder if they just got Bob to do that.
Hey Bob, just be a love, will you? Be a pet. Put that in the post for me.
So, yeah, so this episode wraps up. They found this letter. It is identical. Beverly is spelt wrong on both of the letters.
But
and
hang on, here's where it all goes wrong for me. It's when they've got that letter. So the show's producers and Andrew Jarecki have that letter, right? What should they do with it, in your opinion?
Oh, they go through all that on the next episode, so I've got prior knowledge.
Oh, okay. Well, here's how I looked at it. They're withholding the letter from the police, and they're going to hijack Robert Durst. Again, that's the third hijack in this episode.
Yeah.
Well, no, they should go straight to the police.
Well,
they've got evidence.
He's just got away with... Listen, Matt, he's just gotten away with murder, first off. Secondly, what they're going to do, give it a struck, and he's going to... What's that, a letter? I mean, anyone can write anything wrong. You know, who had the letter? That's what I want to know. Like, you're there, struck as number two if your notepad going, open and shut case, boss. Probably a junkie. Yeah, anyone can get shot in the back of the head after being let into someone's home and you turn the back on them. But, so they put in a safety deposit box. Yeah. And plus, here's the thing, right? You've got a letter that now incriminates Bob Durst. I wouldn't be surprised if Andrew Jarecki got shot in the back of the head of the next fucking episode.
There is,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so there is also that on it. So, this is a great... I mean, it builds up to whatever happens next, doesn't it?
When it stops.
Now it's going into the finale.
Yeah. So, right. Well, let's wrap this up then. I'm going to go watch episode 6 right now.
All right. Do you think we can message Andrew Jarecki with a few questions?
Yes.
I think we should do that for the final recap one.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's... what's the worst he could do? Not contact us.
Just... My memories of the documentary are my own. I have no idea what other people thought of the documentary, nor would I.
Don't forget, Colt Cabana said yes. He came to my show. As did a load of other very minor celebrities on the Edinburgh circuit. Some of whom...
I love you, Matt.
Some of whom...
I love you.
...are now popping up on regular TV programs. So, yes, he might do. And, you know, as we know from Douglas Durst, Andrew Jarecki is not successful. So, you know, we offer him some of that coffee money. Off he comes. We give him some of Dal's dough. He's on his way.
I'll tell you what, we are keeping that £1.50, all right? He's going to do it because he's a nice guy.
Who, Jarecki?
Yeah.
Yeah, we might have to give him final say. And we need this released because we need that Patreon money. So, no, he doesn't get final say.
To be honest, if Robert Durst wants to get in touch and give us some cash to not do the episode, I'm also very open to that. I'm happy with 25k a year from our Bobby D.
Yeah, I'm in for that. Yeah.
So we'll email them both to see who gets back to us.
I bet Jarecki gets back to us before Durst. Right, I'm going to wrap this up because I want to go and see what happens.
Thank you very much for listening. Tune in for part 6.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.